The following audio is from Gold Country Baptist Church in Shingle Springs, California. Visit gcb.church to find more resources and to learn about our church.
August 11th, 2024, 12 Extraordinary Women, Hannah, A Portrait of Feminine Grace.
So, who knows what the name Hannah means? You can't answer all the questions because you read the chapter.
I might have forgotten.
Memory is not there.
That's right.
Anyway, Grace, yes. So the name Hannah means grace. We'll be in 1 Samuel mostly and part of 2 Samuel, well, most of it. So after I studied her, I thought, well, she needed a lot of grace because she was married. So you need a lot of grace when you're married. She could not bear children. So that takes a lot of grace. She was married to a man who was a bigamist, who took a second wife so that he could have offspring. So you need a lot of grace to live with another woman in your home. And that wife taunted her and was her rival. She pled with the Lord for a son, and she vowed to give the son back to the Lord for service. She took her son back to the temple to be raised by Eli, the high priest, even though she knew Eli was a terrible father with unbelieving sons who would be a part of Samuel's life. So she needed a lot of grace. In Samuel, so the background history of Samuel. Originally, Samuel was one book. Most of our first and second, third, they were all originally one book. So at some point it was split and became two. But originally, even before that, it was one book with kings. So it was called the Book of Kingdoms. And this is because this was during the time when there was no king in Israel. And so if you ever see some reference to the kingdoms, the Book of Kingdoms, it's Kings and Samuel put together in the original Hebrew. Hannah lived in Israel with her husband Elkanah. They lived in the territory occupied by the tribe of Ephraim, which is pronounced Ephraim, I heard. Okay, if you recall, when Joshua divided all the tribes after, you know, they got into the promised land and he gave them each their own land, but which tribe got no land?
The Levites.
The Levites. So they're a part of the family of Levi. And Elkanah was through Kohath, was in the tribe of Levi. The Kohathites were one of the three major tribes of Levi. Mm-hmm. So then there were three breakoffs of Levi. Moses and Aaron were Kohathites. They were assigned. So in the Levitical responsibilities of the people in the temple, tabernacle, they were assigned responsibilities. His family took care for and made the most, they were assigned to care for and make the most sacred furnishings of the tabernacle, including the Ark of the Covenant. When Israel would move camps, they were responsible to disassemble the Holy of Holies and transport the Ark and all sacred utensils according to the strict procedure. So this is the line of her husband Elkanah. Once Israel occupied the Promised Land, the Kohathites devoted themselves to other priestly functions, especially leading music, prayer, and praise in the tabernacle. Elkanah has some famous uncle who was a singer. Elkanah's family probably settled originally in the land of Ephraim, and then so you'll see him be called an Ephraimite, but he's really not. It was just because that's the tribe that took, settled with them because they didn't have their own land. So they became Ephraimites according to their land. But it's clear that they are of the tribe of Levi. So that's our little background. And this is during the time of the judges in Israel's history, the bad judges, right? There were no righteous judges in the land, and they had no king. And the people were always looking for the one to come, right? The one, the ruler, to come and rescue them. So every theme of every book of the Old Testament is pointing towards the Messiah. So we know that Hannah was expecting this. She was wanting this person to come, and she was waiting for it. So Hannah's character was gracious, but her home life was troubled and sorrowful. Her husband was a bigamist, as I said, and I know we can't really understand this, but it was very common, especially if a woman was barren. So let's pick up in verse 2. He had two wives. The name of, sorry, it's chapter 1, verse 2, 1 Samuel. He, Elkanah, had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. So obviously there's severe tensions in the home, right? And usually they would take a wife because they weren't producing. The other wife wasn't producing a line of the heirs. And then we'll see. Okay, verse 3 through 7. Now this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship, which was in Ephraim, to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. On the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion, because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. And her rival used to provoke her grievously and irritate her, because the Lord had closed her womb. So her rival is Peninnah, the lady she lives with in her home. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. So we know that they followed the tradition. They were devoutly religious and went every year, because that was when, what did you do every year at the temple? Sacrifice. Yeah, we've been learning this in Exodus, right? So they would go every year faithfully. So Elkanah loved the Lord. He wanted to serve the Lord. He brought his family to the temple to worship and to offer sacrifices. They were clearly devoted to the Lord. And when Elkanah sacrificed in the temple, he gave a peace offering. So that's how they were, made right with God. And do you guys remember anything so far that we've learned about the peace offering from Sunday mornings?
Well, it was an example of Christ being the ultimate peace offering.
Right. The go-between, yeah. And so when they took the peace offering to the priests, the priest would cook it, and then what? Do you remember? So they would give a portion to the Lord, but they would give you back the rest. So from that food, that's what Elkanah fed his family. Mm-hmm. So he gave Peninnah a portion and Hannah a portion, but Hannah got the bigger portion. And Elkanah loved Hannah more, so he gave her the double portion. But Hannah had no one to share her portion with. So it was almost like a rebuke to her, because Peninnah had all these children. When I was listening to one sermon, and he said, it's like the homeschool family with the, 15-passenger van. Like, that was Peninnah's family. And then there's Hannah. So she has this huge portion, no one to share it with. And then Peninnah, who got, I'm sure they all got fed. But, she was obviously jealous. And then Hannah was obviously knew she had no one to share it with. So it was kind of, even though he's thinking, I love you more, I'm going to give you double. You know, it was a, yeah, not so thoughtful, maybe. Maybe with good intent, but bad application.
Maybe she had, maidservants or something.
Yeah, I don't know. It didn't say
why
anything.
Would she want, like, all that?
That's what she's saying. She's like, I don't need this. And then she was, you know, so distraught that she didn't even want to eat. Yeah, he's. Well, it's way of showing love, right? Our husbands don't always show us love the way we want to be shown love, but the way they want to be shown love, maybe. I don't know. So anyway, she was favored. She was the favored wife. And, I mean, having a rival in your home who taunts you constantly, I mean, that's just cause for bitterness, right? And the Lord had closed her womb. And just like Sarah and Rachel, she knew, you know, this is, he divinely closes a womb. But like Sarah, God told her, you will have children, you will have many. Even though she didn't completely believe him.
But that's till she was 90.
Yeah. But she had a little hope at that point, right?
Sure.
I mean, at least, like, she was told at some point, you will have children, where Hannah was never told that. So, and then Rachel was never told that. So it's hopeless. It feels hopeless. I know. I thought I would never have children. You know, look at me now and think that, but it feels hopeless when you don't know if you can have children. So it wasn't just for, she didn't know. Was it for a time? Was it forever? She didn't know. So verse 7, it went on year by year. As often as they went up to the house of the Lord, she provoked her, and Hannah would weep and not eat. So this was happening every year, every year, every year. And then what does her husband say to her? Verse 10, yay! Verse 9. After they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat. Oh, I'm sorry, I missed it. Verse 8. I forgot my Bible, so I like memorized this in my Bible. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? Like, again, I think his intent was really good, but badly delivered. No, you are not better than 10 sons. You know, I'm sure she thought. But she did what he asked her to. Eat. Please eat. Please eat. He cared for her. He wanted her well physically, and he loved her, and he didn't want to see her sad. And so he did really, truly care for her. And I was thinking about it. Maybe she was just fasting in prayer, right? Just fasting before the Lord in her sorrow and in her just anguish. But he got her to eat. But then what does she do right after? She, after they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple. So she rose, went back in to pray. She ate, got back in. So she did what she was told to do, ate her portion, and then she went back in to pray. So verse 9, okay, I just read that. Verse 10, I'm going to read all the way to 18 just so it kind of flows. I'll start at 9 again. After they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said to the Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life. and no razor shall touch his head. As she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart, only her lips moved, and her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli took her to be a drunken woman. And Eli said to her, "How long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you." But Hannah answered, "No, my lord, I am a woman troubled in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman, for all along I have been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation." Then Eli answered, "Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition that you have made to him." And he said, "Let your servant find favor in your eyes." Then the woman went her way, ate again, and her face was no longer sad. We're in 1 Samuel 1. So Eli thought she was drunk. Why would he think that? Because his sons were bringing immoral women into the temple, but also because in Israel at that time, public prayer was always out loud. And it made me wonder if that's where, like, the Pharisees started, you know, the outward prayers that sounded so good and not the fervent prayer of the heart.
If you go to the Wailing Wall,
yeah,
they're all
that's what I was thinking. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was always the custom to go pray out loud.
Yeah.
But at some point it turned into maybe a show of, mm-hmm. you know, not the heart, but the words. But she wasn't praying out loud. She was just, you know, lamenting, really. Mm-hmm. She was, verse 10, she was greatly distressed, great distress, and wept bitterly. So she was lamenting her soul to the Lord. And I was thinking about this, like, have you guys been in that place where you're just lamenting your soul to the Lord? Or does it feel wrong? Where are you guys at in your lamenting journey of prayer before the Lord? Anybody want to share anything?
I think with our Western world and culture, it's considered sometimes like you're maybe not grateful. But rather, you know, you're not grateful if you don't trust in the Lord, right? And if you blaspheme him. But when you're lamenting truly, when you see that, like in the book of Psalms and throughout the other parts of Scripture, they're addressing the Lord, and they're asking him why this is happening or not happening. So there's great faith and also trust that he's sovereign, because hey, if you're God, you could make something happen here, right? And so it's just a way that they did, you know, in the old times to worship and honor God, but in their sorrow, in pleading for him to help them to make sense of it.
Yeah, for sure.
A different translation on my phone, it says, "And she, bitter of soul, prayed to Yahweh and wept despondently." I think, like, lamenting has a different connotation to it than bitterness does.
Yeah.
And so you just have to check your heart.
Like, yeah.
It's okay to be sad and lament and let that out to the Lord. He knows anyways, but bitterness is a different thing.
Yeah.
But I wonder if that bitterness of the soul is an off translation.
I don't know.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. Because there's nothing there that indicates that she's bitter and retaliatory or that type of thing.
I think the ESV said she wept bitterly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So does the American Standard.
Yeah, that idea is there. I don't know.
She's not angry. I think the point is angry at God.
Yeah. You know what I love? We were talking about study Bibles at Young Adult Group the other night, and I said, but what I hate about study Bibles is the one verse I have a question on, there's no little note for me to read. Right. So there's no note on verse 10
yeah.
about weeping bitterly. But, yeah, I think even if you are bitter, sometimes when you get that out before the Lord, it turns to mm-hmm. something else, right? Mm-hmm. So we're going to be sinful even in our prayer. But we don't want to start from a place of bitterness if at all possible. So start your lamenting as sorrow before it turns to bitterness, right? And I was thinking of Psalm 22. This is like the classic lamenting psalm. There's many, but this is one. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me and the words of my groanings? Oh, my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night I find no rest. Yet you are holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel, in our fathers trusted. They trusted you, and you delivered them. To you they cried and were rescued. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. So it just keeps going. But... and then it goes back to but I am a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind and despised by the people. So he keeps going back and forth, like praise, lament. And I think it is a good practice to, when you're deeply sorrowed, to take it to the Lord like that. And even if you don't know what to pray, just go to one of those Psalms mm-hmm. and ask the Lord to use it, in your own heart. To get you back on track.
I went to the Greek
okay.
to see what it says. It says it's a primitive word root to weep, generally to bemoan, bewail, complain, make lamentation, mourn, sore with tears and weep.
That's what I thought. It was.
What was the word? What word was?
Baka.
Baka. For the weep bitterly?
For the bitterly.
Bitterly. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it talks about the bitter herbs that they would eat in Passover were right. to remind them of their harsh circumstances that the Lord brought them out of. And so we have bitter circumstances. We have sad circumstances that we can weep over. And that's the bitterly that they're talking about in that, mm-hmm. situation. It's just, it's the law that was, cast for her that is sad,
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For sure. Okay, so verses 10 and 11. She was in bitterness of soul, but yet not the kind of bitterness that's sinful, just the deep anguish of weeping and sorrow, and prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish. She made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, she's reminding him, I'm your servant, remember me, and don't forget me, like she keeps saying it, and I think we can feel forgotten by God a lot, and Hannah obviously is asking him, don't forget me, we know he doesn't forget us, but you might feel that way sometimes, and she asks, but we'll give your maidservant a male child, not a child, a male child. Mm-hmm. Then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. Have you guys ever made a bargain with the Lord before? Throwing your fleece out. If you do this, then I'll do that. I have.
I try not to
either, but when I was younger,
yeah.
I definitely did.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what she's doing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a vow, but she doesn't know how he's going to respond. And there's two parts to her vow. So the first part is a promise to give her child to the Lord, mm-hmm. and she intended to devote him to full-time service in the tabernacle. Mm-hmm. Now, remember, they're in the Levitical line, so her family mm-hmm. can work in the tabernacle.
Right.
But... if you remember, as a priest, like Zechariah, for example, he only had to serve certain times. So it wasn't, you weren't on duty all the time.
No.
So she's making a vow that he will serve full time forever. No going back. And then she adds the Nazarite vow. which was to never cut his hair. Mm-hmm. And both parts of the vow were consecrated, her son for life, to the duties that normally would have been only temporary. Mm-hmm. And we know Samson, the Nazarite vow, Samson's Nazarite vow, which the Lord gave his mom before he was even born, was for life, and possibly John the Baptist. And I thought that was interesting how, and Samson's mom was barren, Hannah was barren, and Elizabeth was barren. And then God put these men in the line to, you know, bring glory to him and to help Israel. So all three were mothers that had been barren that were given sons to serve the Lord. And Hannah wanted him to be a godly man, serving and glorifying the Lord all his life. And so she did not make this promise lightly. It wasn't just like, I'll send him for a little while and then I'll get him back. She knew she was giving him up for the rest of her life, at least, or his life, whichever came first. And Eli's response, so this is then, okay, after her vow, Eli's response was insensitive because he asked, how long will you go on being drunk, right? He's not looking at a woman who, you know, her heart was just being poured out to the Lord. So he wasn't even thinking the best of her. He was used to seeing drunk, immoral women in the tabernacle coming to visit his sons, which we'll get to them later. And he probably assumed she was just one of them. After she tells him, I've been pouring out my soul before the Lord, Eli realizes she's genuine and quickly changes his tune. And he gives her a blessing. But what I thought was interesting is he has no idea what she was asking of the Lord. And he gave her a blessing just because he did love the Lord. He was a terrible father and an okay priest, but he loved the Lord and was faithful in some of it. So verse 17, may the Lord of Israel grant your petition that you have asked of him. And she went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. So he gave her hope. He gave her hope that the Lord was going to hear her cry. And the other, I had this question for Phil. I was like, so why was Eli there all the time? And he said he was the high priest. He didn't have to take a turn. He was there. That was his permanent position. Mm-hmm. So he stayed in the temple. I'm sure he did love the Lord and yet was a sinner, just like so many others. So I was thinking about Hannah's distinctive characteristics. She was constant. She kept coming back to the temple, coming back to pray. She had a steadfast faith. She stayed before the Lord, even with a broken heart, and pouring out tearful prayers. I think we can tend to pull away from the Lord sometimes when we are sorrowful or sad at our circumstances. Her trials didn't lead her to despair, but they made her a woman of prayer. Mm-hmm. There's my woman's tagline. Don't despair, be a woman of prayer. And then we know, okay, so they go home, they leave the temple. He says, go in peace. And she went her way. They rose early in the morning, worshipped again before the Lord. Verse 19, then they went back to their house at Ramah, and Elkanah knew his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And in due time, Hannah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Samuel. For she said, I have asked for him from the Lord. Okay. Now, now it comes. She has the baby. And she, he hears her cry. She names him Samuel, which means, we're not sure, name of God, asked from God, or heard by God. They're not sure. Now comes the time of year again. So, you know, she gets pregnant, has this baby. Now it's a year later. And she comes back. It's the one verse, but it's, you know, whole year. And Elkanah and all his house, verse 21, went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up. For she said to her husband, as soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him, so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever. Elkanah, her husband, said to her, do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word. So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. So, you know, I have some speculations on Elkanah, but maybe he didn't care. Maybe he just trusted her. He really trusted her, I think. But you'd think he wouldn't want his only son from his favorite wife given away. Mm-hmm. But he trusted her, I think. And it just reminded me of Proverbs 31:11. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. So,
and that makes me think that back with the vows, if the woman made a vow and she was married, and her husband allowed her to keep it, she had to keep it.
Mm.
But he had the power
to break
have her
it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
So he knew that. So
yeah.
So he must have trusted.
Yeah.
Her,
yeah.
He could have rescinded it.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said, he truly loved her, and he mm-hmm. wanted her to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did what
yeah.
what she said she was going to do. He let her do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought about how do we develop our character so that our husbands are trusting us? What makes our husbands trust us or others trust us? What makes people trust us as trustworthy?
Being steadfast, loyal, and having a reputation for integrity and honesty.
Yeah. Doing what you say you're going to do. Yeah. Yeah. So he honored her. He, and then as a mother, you know, our love for our husbands can just profoundly influence our children. And so I'm sure, I don't know how long Samuel, they say until he was weaned, which was like maybe 3 years. I kind of think it was longer.
It could be 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. So she obviously loved her husband, and I'm sure Samuel saw that. Even with all their imperfect domestic issues of, you know, double marriage, they had a healthy marriage, and they worshiped God regularly. So now let's move on to verses 24 through 28. When she had weaned him, she took him up with her, along with a 3-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, and a skein of wine. And she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh, and the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull, and they brought the child to Eli, and said, O my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who was standing here in your presence, praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition that I made to him. Therefore I have lent him to the Lord as long as he lives. He is lent to the Lord. That's a different translation. What does it say in instead of lent,
dedicated,
yeah, because we would say lent means you're borrowing
yeah.
something to be given back, and he worshipped the Lord there. So she goes back. She has this in Numbers. It talks about the bull, the flour, and the wine were to be sacrificed in fulfillment of a vow. So if you made a vow and were going to fulfill it, that's what you sacrificed. A bull, flour, and wine. But she brought it in great abundance. And some think it's because she hadn't come for years to worship, but, you know, nobody really knows. And then we get to chapter 2. And this is where Hannah parallels Mary, because this is her Magnificat, her prayer to the Lord. Okay, I'm going to read it. And Hannah prayed and said, "My heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord, for there is none beside you. There is no rock like our God. Let no arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne 7, but she who has many children is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap, to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. Not by might shall man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed." So here's her, you know, her Magnificat. And John MacArthur said, "If you gave me this text to preach on, it would take a series of several sermons to unpack its prophetic and doctrinal significance. But we can see how familiar Hannah was with the deep things of God. She knew her God. Some attributes she acknowledged in her prayer were his goodness, his sovereignty, his power, his wisdom, and she worshipped him as her Savior, as Creator, and as the Sovereign Judge." So, I mean, this woman knew the Lord and knew him intimately. And so then the next verse, 11, "Then Elkanah went home to Ramah, and the boy was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest." So I was like, I don't think he's 3 years old. You know, I don't know if you're ministering to. Yeah. And Phil was saying that his job was to light the candles. And he's like, I don't think you'd give that job to a 3-year old. So maybe, I don't know. Who knows how old this kid was really at the time. But he was young. It says he was young. Mm-hmm. Or what responsibilities he was given right away. I wondered, what did Eli think? Like, oh no, now I have to raise this little boy, right? You know, it doesn't say anything. It doesn't say anything about what Eli thought about it. But yeah, all my speculations. Who knows? But she worshipped the Lord, and she knew her time with Samuel would be short, and she knew she'd be leaving him with Eli. And besides being a priest, we know that Eli was not a great dad because he had these two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and they must have also been high priests because they were there throughout the whole story. And they were known as the two good-for-nothing priests. Because, let's read what they did, verse 12. "Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. The custom of the priests with the people was that when a man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a 3-pronged fork in his hand. And he would thrust it in the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot, and that the fork brought up the priest would take for himself. This was what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, 'Give meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw.' And if the man said to him, let them burn the fat first, and then take as much as you wish, he would say, no, you must give it now, and if not, I will take it by force. Thus the sins of the young men was very great in the sight of the Lord, for the men treated the offering of the Lord with contempt.
Yeah, they weren't supposed to eat the fat.
Yeah, they weren't supposed to. And they took double portions or extra portions. They also, I think, took money. And they were just all around scoundrels, right? Not who you want serving your church, right? Mm-hmm. And we know Christian history, like, there's been bad leaders in church. So they were just the two first that happened to be named in Scripture. So I was I listened to another sermon, and it was basically on parenting. And he gave Eli as the example of, you know, how not to parent, because Eli was the permissive parent. So he went to them and said, you need to stop doing this. But he never enforced or gave correction. Yeah. So just to be careful how we approach children or people we see with children in their homes, like, permissive parenting is rampant in the Christian church, I believe. And here we have a clear example of what happens. And it could have happened even if Eli was super faithful.
I was going to say, our oldest daughter did some things, and we were pretty strict.
Yeah.
You know, because
it's in their heart, right?
It's in their heart, and they're not clones. They're going to do what they're going to do.
Yeah.
If they're intending to
right.
do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah. We can't judge us.
No, but we do know what he did. Yeah. So it's like, okay, don't do that.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking about Hannah. Because here she is giving her precious one and only baby to this man mm-hmm. to raise. Mm-hmm. And I just think in our Christian culture, we make all of our decisions for our children based on a lot of fear. Are they going to be exposed to something? Are they going to be influenced? She knew what was in that house, and she gave her son and trusted the Lord. And so it just reminded me that we need to not be so fearful of what is going to corrupt them. Because like you said, you can do all the right things. They're going to do what they wish if their hearts are evil.
And I thought with Eli, he screwed up with his sons. But with Samuel, he'd have been more like a grandpa.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, and mm-hmm. kind of a second chance.
And Samuel was obedient, so it was a little easier.
That may have been a whole different
I'm sure it was. Right? I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we know the end of the story, that Samuel turned out great, right? Because the Lord had his hand on him the entire time, regardless of whether Eli was good or not for him. But just not being fearful for our children and their path, not being fearful of what might be exposed to them and who might say something, or, you know, I just thought, here's a kid growing up in the temple with prostitutes and drunkards and mm-hmm. corruption, and yet the Lord protected him because he had a plan for Samuel, mm-hmm. bigger than any exposure he was going to get from these worldly influences. And then let's go to 2:22 through 25 and see what happens to them. Eli was very old, and he kept hearing all that his sons were doing in all of Israel, and how they lay with the women who were serving at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And he said to them, why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. No, my sons, it is no good report that I hear the people from the Lord spreading abroad. If someone sins against a man, God will mediate for him. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to put them to death. Now the boy Samuel continued to grow both in stature and favor with the Lord and also with man. And the way they were put to death was that they took the Ark of the Covenant to battle with the Philistines, and the Philistines stole it, and God struck them dead. And then when Eli heard of it, he died. Probably had a heart attack or something. So he loved these boys, and his sorrow for their sins also affected him. So it was just sad, super sad. And then 3:12, it says, "On that day I will fulfill against Eli all that I have spoken concerning this house from beginning to end, and I declare to him that I am about to punish his house forever for the iniquity that he knew, because his sons were blaspheming God, and he did not restrain them. Therefore, I swear to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever." So they couldn't even sacrifice to get forgiveness for these things. So the Lord really punished them. But lastly, let's just end with Hannah, because that's who we're talking about here. So chapter 2, verse 18. Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a boy, clothed with a linen ephod, which is like a dress, kind of a linen tunic. And his mother used to make for him a little robe and take it to him each year when she went up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. So she got to visit him once a year, and she would spend this time, make him this little special robe each year as he grew, and give it to him. I'm sure she looked forward to that time all year long. And Eli blessed Elkanah and his wife and said, "May the Lord give you children by this woman for the petition she asked of the Lord." So then they would return to their home. Indeed, the Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and bore 3 sons and 2 daughters. And the boy Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord. So he blessed her over and over with more children after this. And we can see God's hand in why he wanted Samuel and why he orchestrated all this. So she didn't see all that, but she trusted. So let's trust the Lord in our lives and in our relationships. All right, let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for Hannah and her faithfulness, and that we can learn from her. And she wasn't a perfect woman, but she loved you, Lord. And just give us hearts and minds to want to know you more and to deeply know you more. And we thank you. We pray for the service today and all those who are involved in worship and teaching, and just give them strength and clarity as they draw us towards, point us towards you, Lord. In your name, amen.